Thanks to everyone for coming. We think a couple more will be arriving. Hi, Darcy. Duties. And I understand for some non-LSC people, finding this room with this particular name has been a little problematic. So, delighted to welcome back our speaker. Dimitris Katsikas is familiar with the LSE in different ways, in a moment. He's currently Assistant Professor of International and European Political Economy and Director of the Research Center for Economic Policy, Governance and Development, the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at the National and Capodistrian University of Athens. Some of you will also know his work whilst he was director of the Crisis Observatory at ELIMEP, the Nick Foundation for Foreign Policy and European Studies in Athens. And more relevantly, perhaps, is that Dimitris gained his PhD from the LSE here in the field of international political economy in 2008. We were, as the Hellenic Observatory, very pleased to host him as a visiting fellow in the recent past. And of course, he has published a number of papers in major Greek and European journals and outlets, and his focus has been on the impact of the crisis, European and Greek crises. This evening he's going to be talking to us about crisis, clientelism and institutional resilience, reflections on a public sector reform under the memorandums of understanding. A project which is of much interest to the Hellenic Observatory, and it's great to welcome Dimitris back. We look forward to your presentation, Dimitris.
Thank you very much. So, shall I move on to
you might need to do it from those.
Okay. So thank you. Professor Featherstone, thank you everybody for coming here this evening. The research I'm going to present to you today, as Professor Featherstone said, is the outcome of my stint here last spring as a PhD senior fellow at the Hellenic Observatory. I'm glad to take, of course, this opportunity to thank the Hellenic Observatory and Professor Featherstone for hosting me, for giving me this time to work undistracted on this, on this topic. The broader topic that this particular presentation falls in, which is the political economy of structural reforms, particularly conditions of crisis, external conditionality, has been, as Professor Featherstone said, one of my main preoccupations research-wise in recent years, particularly after the creation of the Crisis Observatory, actually before the ELIMEP. And it has been the subject of a number of research projects I participated in, and this particular as well, reform, has been also part of my research agenda in the past, and you will see some evidence of that in this presentation. Now, why is this an important topic? I think the difficulty of promoting and implementing reforms in Greek political economy has been stable. Literature on Greece for many, many years now, and actually Professor Featherstone has been one of the major contributors to that research area well before the crisis. We knew that there was a broad consensus that in Greece it's very difficult to put forward reforms and actually implement them, despite the fact that it was a broad consensus that there were many structural weaknesses in both the private economy and the public sector. During the crisis, the previous economic, socio-economic, and political status quo became largely unraveled, and there was massive pressure for reform coming both from domestic forces, society at large, and also new or strengthened political actors. that previously were at the margins of the political system, and of course the international creditors, who put forward a very ambitious structural reforms program. Now, despite these facts, and the fact that, despite all this pressure, and the fact that this reforms program was monitored not by one but by two international creditors, the IMF and the European Union, I think there's broad consensus, and Professor Sipedeston, among others, Stella Lavi, who's here with us, also have written that, you know, the record is quite mixed. There were failures, some successes, but a lot of omissions, gaps, delays, so an inconsistent implementation record despite all this pressure and monitoring by these two institutions. Now, for some people, this is not a surprise, given Greece's past track record with reforms I just mentioned. But I think this is not a helpful way to approach this theme because, first of all, as I said, this was a mixed record. So there were not only delays and failures, but also successes. So we need to go past this success or failure, a kind of simplistic approach, and try to investigate in more depth why, and try to explain the particular pattern that we observe, why some aspects of one reform were implemented where others were not, why some reforms were implemented where others were not, and so on. Secondly, I think we should not underestimate the impact of the crisis. In institutional theory, crises are usually identified as critical junctures, so you know, major moments in time when crisis upsets things and leaves room for new socioeconomic actors and coalitions to come up and change the previous institutional path and start a new one. But if ever there was a crisis that satisfied these conditions, this was a big crisis. Not only because probably the deepest and longest economic crisis of the developed economy in the post-World War II period, also it created a huge social crisis and a political crisis as well, which radically reshaped the political landscape in Greece, which had been stable since the restoration of democracy back in 1974. Therefore, I think the when we're talking about institutional resilience and resistance to reforms, this, in the context of this crisis, is something that needs to be, it's an empirical puzzle that needs to be investigated, not taken for granted. Now, so the focus of my presentation is about one particular reform, which is the single remuneration system in the public sector during the MOU's era. So this effectively is the system, a set of rules, if you like, through which public sector employees are being paid. Now, as I said before, and in line with the more generic picture I described before, the implementation of the reform was partial, erratic, marked by reversals, but some successes as well. I will present them later on. And the paradigm, but the paradigm shifting elements of the reform were not implemented. So, if you like, the research question is how we explain the implementation of this particular reform, where we had some successes, but we also have failures, particularly the most important, if you like, most radical elements of the reform. So obviously the objective here is not to you know, examine in huge detail this particular reform, which was important and quite symbolic actually in the context of the crisis, but to uncover through in a case study analysis, through process tracing analysis in particular, an explanatory mechanism which could perhaps help us explain reforms, reform resistance, and resilience, institutional resilience in other reforms in the context of the crisis or in other reforms before the crisis or less, we'll come back to this in the end. So what is of interest, as I write here, is not an induced radical occurrence of specific reform, but rather a process of reform of the second conditions, namely extreme crisis and external conditionality. So let me start by describing a bit the picture before the crisis of the system that the public sector were being paid in Greece. Now I'm relying a lot of an ICAP study that came out, was commissioned by the government actually very early during the crisis. And of course the evidence that is presented in this study can be found particularly in anecdotal form in the literature many years before. But this study kind of was the most updated and comprehensive study, which looked exactly at the way the system worked and the problems and imbalances that it had. So codifying and summarizing a bit the findings of the study, The system, the payment system, was bureaucratic and inward looking. It was not related, yes.
Could I just ask what is the ICAP study?
ICAP is, sorry, yes, it's my mistake. ICAP is a consulting company, so it's a consulting company. So the government commissioned the company to make an independent study on the payment system in the public sector. So it was bureaucratic to the system and inward looking. It was completely separated from, if you like, policy making priorities or new initiatives or anything like that, which anyway in Greece we know are most of the time lacking. The Greek policy making model is more ad hoc and problem solving oriented rather than forward looking, setting agendas and so on. Most importantly, there was pervasive fragmentation. There were huge differences between the wages that people got, and the main differentiating factor was actually the ministry or public entity to which they belonged. Just to give you a measure of the differences, for some ministries, the median wage was 20 to 50% higher than that of the entire distribution, and differences between individual ministries could be as high as 75%. So it was you and another fellow, and you had the same pretty much tasks, the same qualifications, the same rank, but you worked in different ministries. And I could get 75% higher wages than the other guy, or vice versa, simply because I was working in Ministry A and they were working in Ministry B. These and many other imbalances of this type were quite common. Of course, this type of payment system obviously is decoupled from great task performance. And this, of course, created disincentives for taking initiative, for assuming responsibility, for improving activity or performance more generally. Years of service and typical qualifications were the main parameters that were taken in consideration for moving up the wage ladder, and even these parameters were less important after the middle of the wage ladder. So what you had was a quite compressed, flat wage distribution. So everybody were quite close in terms of the wages, irrespective of the tasks, managerial duties, responsibilities, performance, and so on. And that was the case with the wages. A similarly fragmented and fully implemented benefits policy was also quite apparent. There were many, many different allowances, over 100 different allowances. And there were some really crazy cases. To give you a few examples, one public, this, the worst of the excesses were in public corporations, which are part of general governments. So one corporation, there was an allowance for coming to work on time. In another was an allowance for lunch. Well, we're talking 200-300 euros per month, no peanuts for Greece. There was an allowance for lunch, whereas at the premises of the corporation, there was a restaurant which gave out free lunches to the employees. So on top of that, they would get an allowance for lunch. An allowance for working with computers. That's everybody after a while. So these and other kinds of these examples were too many to say. So we had this kind of irrational kind of approach, and even in some cases where there were allowances that were linked to performance, these were either very low or were pretty much received by everybody. Because in the very rudimentary system for valuation that exists, everybody got 10 out of 10. I actually got to experience that during my military service, because after coming back from the border, I was posted the human resources with the Turkish Greek Army, and I had access to the files, and the valuation was like, okay, he's, yeah, okay, 10. 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, everybody got 10 out of 10. And, you know, without any consideration at all. I mean, you need to have a very, very serious reason not to get 10 out of 10. So everybody was perfect, and everybody took all the allowances irrespective of performance rate. So given this situation, what were the objectives of the reform? And this is based on legislative tests that promoted to reduce the reform. First of all, of course, rationalize payment. That is, introduce a common set of rules and based on certain criteria that would be applicable to everybody. and this would eliminate special wage regimes and allowances, arguably. Link wages to tasks of productivity, decompress the wage structure as a result, and develop an integrated human resources management system. This is referred to many times in the legislation and in the also in the memorandum as well. That this payment system should be part of a more broader integrated human resources management system. So how was the reform implemented? The reform, actually, the implementation of the reform took many years, 6 or 7 years, or rather, not exactly the implementation, but anyway, it happened in two stages between 2010 and 2012, the early reform, if you like, and then 2015, 2016, there was also legislation introduced that affected this reform. Now, all the innovations were part of the early reform that happened between 2000 and 2012 in a few steps. So the positive innovations, if you like, is that there was indeed a rationalization of the payment scheme. So there was indeed introduced a set of rules with specific criteria about how people should get paid. And this covered a large part, not everybody, of public servants. So the significance of the employment institution was reduced. But it was not totally eliminated, and I will come back to that later to see the reason why. Now, as a result of this criteria that were reduced, the returns to education and work experience were higher after the reform, and managerial posts received a higher premium. So educational qualifications, work experience, and managerial responsibilities were rewarded more. So you would get higher wages as a result if you had these things. Now, of these, more than 100 different allowances were replaced with three basic allowances common for employees. And the link of payment was linked to rank. So there was a basic level, wage level linked to all basic ranks. And as you move to the ranks to promotion, you get a promotion, then you move to the next wage level. Of course, there were subcategories within its rank. And for all this to work, also there was an evaluation system planned that was supposed to link promotions and pay to productivity. Okay, so these are some of the, and this would come, this evaluation scheme would be described in a presidential decree that would soon after the first laws, couple of laws were introduced, would be signed. This never happened. It's a spoiler, but what can you do? So this is just to get an image of the effects of the reform. So I have to say, again, this data is part of an older project we did at the Crisis Observatory. It was assigned to us by the Bank of Greece. It was about structural reforms under the first memoranda. And as a case study, we had the single remuneration stipend. And we had it because we had a unique database. It's all due to my colleagues, Marianthi Anastasadou and Elisabeth Nitsi. They were, Marianthi was working at the time at the Ministry of Finance, and Nitsi, Elisabeth was and is still a researcher at the Public Research Center. And they were able to get the actual public servants' wage data and the actual data from the census data. Because in 2009-2010, there was a census made. Because we didn't know how many public servants there were, what they were doing, what they were features, and so on and so forth. So they combined the two databases and created a big unique database with over 200,000 after all the clearing. Initially, there were more than 300,000 public servants in the database, but more than 200,000 public servants, and we have all their data, anonymized, of course, but we have all the data in terms of gender, age, educational qualifications, position, tasks, and the wages, of course. So we had the actual data, and there was an analysis made before and after the introduction of the reform in 2011. This is the last month before the reform of the previous system, 2012, which is the November 2012, which is the first month that the system was fully operable. So in 2012, you see what I was talking about before. It's before the reform. You see that certain ministries, primarily the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Development or National Economy, and to some degree, Ministry of Justice and Infrastructure were the main beneficiaries of the previous status quo. They were getting way higher wages than compared to other ministries. To give you some data, the Ministry of Finance, which is was benefiting the most from the previous status quo, the median wage stood at almost 2,500 euros, whereas the median wage for the all ministers was about 1,648 euros. It was 49% higher. So the wage, the median wage for the Ministry of Finance was close to 50% higher compared to everybody else. 37% higher for the Ministry of Development. So with the red bars, you see the situation after the introduction of the reform. So you see, plus some other measures that actually reduced wages. So you see everything is downwards, but also more compressed. So some of these big differences were reduced. Now, let's go to the negative aspects, the gaps, the delays, and the reversals. So initially, the coverage was about the central government and local authorities. Gradually, and after mass resistance in the second stage in 2012, public legal entities and operating under private law and public corporations were added, although for many years actually did not comply with the regulations of the new system. And of course, the so-called special remuneration regime, security forces, academics, doctors, judiciary, and still are excluded because it has their own rules, their own regimes. Now, a big issue, a big exception, if you like, to the reform, which kind of defeated the very purpose of the reform to some degree, was the so-called personal difference. The personal difference was for people who get a reduction after the reduction of the system of the wages of more than 25%, that part of over 25% would be, this reduction would be delayed. It would be gradually implemented later on. Initially, legislation said after 2 years. Later, it was replaced with another clause that said it would be phased out when a performance system is introduced with bonuses. So they would lose the personal difference but get the bonuses, the public servants. And effectively, after 2015-16, with some new legislation, became officially permanent. Actually, still today, people get personal difference. So it has not been really been. And this, of course, works in favor of the higher wage earners. So people that had high wages, initially, then they would get the biggest cuts. They were saved from part of the losses. And of course, as you understand, this defeats the purpose of the reform in the sense that exactly the reform was trying to kind of converge, eliminate the big differences that were unjustified simply because you were positioned. The evaluation system that was foreseen and task description that would go along with it was never implemented. The presidential decree I mentioned before never materialized, although I happen to know from interviews that it was ready, but it was never signed off. An integrated human resources management system wasn't even considered. I mean, this was too much. I mean, we were trying to do the basic things here. So this was not really on the cards at any point in time. Now, at the second stage, 2015-2016, actually parts of the reform, of the first reform, were reversed. So the link between pay and rank was abolished. Again, you would move from the wage ladder irrespective of where you were in the ranks. So it was pretty much semi-automatic after you've completed some years in the service, you would get a pay increase. The evaluation system, some form of evaluation system was used, but it was rudimentary and actually was geared towards non-evaluation. It said that everybody should be really evaluated as good or very good, no exceptional, not bad. And actually the law foresaw that a committee would be set up at the ministry to correct, and this is, I quote, to correct the results if you had very, very good employees or very, very bad employees. And getting no promotion should be justified. If you do not automatically promote it, as I said before, through the semi-automatic process, there should be a significant justification. And the previous incentive schemes with previous laws were abolished, were not materialized, and were actually did not appear in the new law. So, what did we have by the end after like years trying to, at the end of 2018, at the end of the memoranda, after 8 years trying to implement this reform. These are answers from interviews I did with high-ranking officials involved in the reform, secretary generals, general directors, directors, head of divisions, and so on. And I asked them to assess the objectives. First of all, how important some of the objectives of the reform were. These are the blue bars. So what you see is that these three objectives are more important from 1 to 6, right? So it's over 4 out of 6, all three of these objectives. The most important, according to all these people, is that there should be an integrated human resource management system, and the payment system should be part of that. And the other two quite important objectives were that you should have a payment system that reflects employee tasks, responsibilities, and productivity. The more operational aspects, if you like, of this to be a single system, be universal and inclusive of all payments, were ranked a bit lower in terms of their importance. The orange bars are how they assess the realization of these objectives. And you see that it's a completely reverse picture. So the more important objectives were not really satisfactorily implemented because they all get below 2 out of 5, so poor implementation record. Whereas all the less important objectives, the more operational, if you like, objectives get 3, close to 3 or above 3 out of 5, so kind of satisfactory, let's say, implementation rate. And this kind of sum up what we got after all these years of trying to implement reform. You got a reform which had a positive impact. It abolished all the unjustified allowances. It abolished the huge differences between ministries. However, it did not entirely eliminate these differences because of the personal difference issue exception. And it never linked payment to evaluation or to productivity or tasks or managerial posts or any of the other stuff. And of course, it was never became part of a more integrated human resource system. Sorry. So we had an incomplete reform. The simpler parts of it, if you like, were satisfactorily implemented. The more radical, the more paradigm shifting elements of the reform that leads to a different type of payment system, payment philosophy, perhaps, were not really implemented. So, how do I account for this outcome? Well, my main explanation, a research hypothesis, which I think but I'm happy to listen to other views, is that the failure to fully implement the reform was due to the political authorities' desire to protect groups which belong to their clientelistic networks. So, an intelligent kind of explanation. There are, of course, in the literature, alternative hypotheses, and people in this room, like Professor Featherstone and Stella Lavie, are responsible for some of these other explanations. So, lack of expert knowledge and reform technology, ideological contrast between the ideological profile and reform mandate and the content of the reforms, contrast between the content of the reforms and the Greek administrative tradition, and inconsistent conditionality strategy. So, as I do in the paper, I'll try to first show why this is not enough to explain fully the outcome and then say how clientele helps us understand better what happens. So if we take the first hypothesis that the reform was not really fully implemented because of lack of expert knowledge and reform technology, I don't think for this particular reform, I don't find it very convincing because actually there have been many reforms earlier to deal with exactly this issue, the payment system. Already from the 80s there were actually initiatives to introduce a single payment system, a half hour evidence already from the 60s actually. I'm pretty sure if I look enough, I can find the 19th century initiatives that were supposed to introduce a single payment system, and all of them were unsuccessful. Actually, right before the crisis, there was a big European program, European funding program, an operational program called Administrative Reform 2007-2013. It was funded by the European Structural Funds. And they actually did a lot of work on these issues as well. And according to the OECD report on the Greek public administration, actually they had ready bills and regulations. I mean, all this work had led to solutions, but these were, who knows why, never enacted. So actually many of the solutions were actually there, the technical solutions were already there, but they were never enacted. Also, you had the ICAP study at the very beginning, which documented in a lot of detail all the problems with the payment system and offered proposals. And you had technical assistance, of course, a lot at the very beginning with public administration experts coming from other countries like France or the Netherlands. And also you had the task force, of course, which is set up exactly for this reason, to provide technical advice with reforms. Plus, the more demanding parts of the reform, if you like, to set up the system and apply to everybody, and also a sister reform, establishment of the single payment authority. So, sister reform to that was that we established the one particular source of payment for everybody, because before that, everybody were paid by their own ministry, public entity, and so on. So, these were more technically demanding, and they were quite set up quite early on. So, you know, introducing the special difference obviously is not an issue of technical knowledge or not linking paid to grade or whatever. These are not technical issues. Now, the second hypothesis, I find weak in this particular reform, and actually more generally to some degree. I think, well, there is no doubt that all governments, particularly the first PASOK government, which was a social democratic government, came to power promising completely different things. Growth and development, and then was handed a crisis, handed the austerity policies, found it quite difficult to compromise the reality with the promises and the dreams. And actually, they did lose a lot of MPs early on in the crisis because of the austerity policies they were promoting. So definitely, there is some element of truth there. But actually, what we see in this reform, but also more generally, is an austerity versus reform paradox. I've seen it in other areas as well. So what you have is the PASOK government, but all governments after PASOK as well, implemented pretty much faithfully the austerity policies, but stalled on the reforms area side, which is kind of weird if you think about it, because the really costly policies, both economically, socially, and politically, were the austerity policies, not reforms. So why implement the austerity reforms and not the other one? In this particular reform, this is even weaker, because if you look at the MOU and you look at the tables, they have every year they have tables about the measures they require the Greek government to take and the projected fiscal savings of each measure. So back in 2010, there was this table that said that the reduction of the 13th and 14th salaries and the limiting of new recruitment in the public sector, these measures were estimated to save yearly more than 2.5 billion euros. Okay. The introduction of the single remuneration system was projected to save 100 million euros. So the motivation and the rationale of this reform was not fiscal in nature. Wages were cut significantly in the crisis, yes, but these were done through other measures unrelated to this reform. And actually, some of them happened even before the memorandum in the spring of 2010, some of the first cuts in wages and benefits. So it was not the reform's objective to reduce wages, but to rationalize them. Therefore, the paradox means that this is works the other way around. Actually, the PASOK government was able to push through, and later governments, policies like abolishing the 13th and 14th salary, which really cut wages, but not put through a reform which fiscally did not have any substantial impact. So it doesn't stand to the evidence. Now, I think the third and fourth hypotheses are more solid, and I definitely agree that they have an element of truth. They can help us explain what happened, but not completely. So there was indeed a contrast between the reforms, which were inspired to some degree by the new public management administrative paradigm, for example, target-based personnel evaluation and the link of pay to productivity and performance, which contrasted heavily with the Greek administrative tradition, which is Napoleonic. Well, people say not even Napoleonic, was Napoleonic, which is heavily formalistic, legalistic, hierarchical, and power is concentrated at the top. So, yes, obviously there was a big tension there, and people were not used to this new kind of practices, and they were reacting and resisting the employees, I mean, the introduction of such measures. And also, there was great inconsistency in the conditional strategy. This is well true as well. I mean, this this argument has been made more thoroughly by Professor Featherstone. Professor Featherstone, but also Professor Spanou, have stressed a lot the inconsistency of the conditionality strategy. Again, there are several layers here, but the most important is that there were different objectives in the conditionality, and particularly in terms of personnel issues, the arbitrary and heavy-handed personnel reduction targets that were required by the IMF, in particular at the beginning of the crisis. They said we need to reduce public servant by 150,000 people by 2015. It was completely arbitrary. I mean, the number made no sense. It was not based on some kind of study or whatever. You know, it was more symbolic, I think, because they were trying to send a message that the way the Greek public sector operated should change. But this actually worked very counterproductively, because it kind of, overshadowed all other reforms that affected public servants, the personnel. So the mobility reform, the payment system reform, the evaluation scheme, the organization of units reform, all of this was overshadowed by the fear that all these were actually like hidden strategies to lay off people. You know, public servants were afraid that all these initiatives, all these reforms were actually just deployed to send them home and meet the IMF's targets. So there was very strong resistance to all these reforms. Having said that, I think so. Both of these arguments, I think, are true in this case. But having said that, I don't think they're enough, because that they don't explain why the governments were so receptive to this type of reaction. The public servants reacted even more strongly when it came to the austerity policies, cutting wages and allowances. But these were implemented anyway. So why, again, we go back to the paradox: why implement so faithfully the austerity policies and back down on the reforms? And I think here the role of the creditors is important, because I think the top priority of the creditors throughout the crisis was fiscal sustainability. It was to reduce the fiscal deficits in order to stop, for them to stop giving money, having to give money, more money to Greece. And this kind of trumped every other priority. And therefore, they're quite insistent on meeting the fiscal targets. And given, I think the Greek government acknowledged this, and given the lack of fiscal space, delays, omissions, exceptions in the reforms was used as a compensation to employees, as an indirect way to limit losses and kind of limit their fear and uncertainty about the future. But then the question comes up: so why, in some cases, there were delays and and omissions and exceptions, and other reforms not? And the answer I give here, and this is where clientelism comes in, is that you would see these kinds of compensation practices in areas where you have thick clientelistic ties, so strong, very strong ties between the political authorities and public sector employees, the so-called political-administrative nexus. Now, we know that in Greece, clientelism is a long-observed phenomenon, and it has many guises. I mean, we and all also all are present from the classical patron system where the local MP goes around and, you know, gives favors to people in exchange for votes, to party machine politics with organized parties acting as distributors of material benefits to get political support, to what Aristantidis, the young scholar, recently introduced, I think, in the literature. It's a very interesting concept and very important in that literature, the client list system of interest intermediation, which is in a higher level, if you like, of clientelism, in the sense that normally independent interest groups like trade unions are embedded in a client list system with the political parties. And this is done by key people who are both party members and trade union leaders. So these people have dual identities, and they kind of link the trade unions' attitude, you know, behaviors and efforts to particular parties. And because they are members of both groups, there is a very high level of interdependence there between these two actors, parties, as principals, trade unions becoming ineffective clients. And because what I argue is that this is kind of this characteristic is endogenous to their operation. This is how political authority works in Greece to a large extent. So it's very difficult to reverse that through reforms. To introduce reforms, implement reforms that would actually harm that and do this bargain, because this strikes at the core of this clientelist network. I think we can see here the exception of the personal difference as evidence of typical clientelistic practice. So the personal difference was introduced at the behest of the employees and trade unionists of the employees of the Ministry of Finance. We saw were the major beneficiaries of the previous system. It was introduced in 2011, and it was proposed by them in 2011 in order to accept the reform, and it was accepted by the government. They applied a lot of pressure, including formal strikes, but also so-called white strikes, which meant that they would go to work, but really not work at all. And of course, you can understand that during the crisis, the leverage of these people was magnified because the entire fiscal consolidation effort was dependent on their performance. So they got their way, and you can see here how evident this is in my mind. This was part of the bargain, clientelistic bargain. These are the personal differences for the different ministries in terms of euros. And you see that for the Ministry of Finance, the personal difference that remained after the reform was 637 euros. So they were still getting over 600 euros that they should be getting if the reform was fully implemented. This should be gradually phased out. The Ministry of National Economy and Development received 277 euros. 90% of employees of all other ministries received personal difference below 38 euros. Yeah.
What year is this?
This is after the reform 2012.
I mean, the personal difference was applied automatically. The problem was not in the how it was done. The problem was that, I mean, it wasn't even a problem, it was a choice, that all personnel, initially the tax inspectors and then even the cleaners, whatever, the Minister of Finance, were getting, what was it, like 30% allow, you know, it was like, you know, if you worked there, in order not to be corruptible, you were getting a 30% of, so then when you implement that, everybody goes below the 25% or below the 75%, so automatically the personal difference kicks in. So it's not that the minister decided, for my ministry, I'm gonna give more. It was that.
I agree. Before the crisis, one of the reasons that the Ministry of Finance employees were getting so much higher wages was they were getting the so-called VIVET, that was an allowance. And they were getting it to be incorruptible. That's ironic. And it was actually also treated, in terms of tax treatment, was treated more favorably than the basic wage. And for some people, actually, the allowance was higher than the basic wage. So a very distorted kind of I agree with you that the personal difference was higher because initially there was so much, they had so much higher wages, but then it was rendered permanent. It was delayed and delayed and delayed and rendered permanent. And so the people that actually benefited from that were these particular groups. So yes, initially, automatically, as you say, kind of calculation you made, they would result in this image, but this never changed afterwards. So I think it was a choice after that, in my mind, was strictly a, clearly a political choice not to inflict more losses to these groups. And this had only happened afterwards in the Syriza and El coalition government. Even before that, in 2012, the initial legal projection was that it would be phased out in a couple of 2 years, but already before that, in 2012 or 13, I don't remember exactly when the new law was passed, this was replaced with another clause that said, when we have a new performance target system, then we will start phasing out the personal difference, and this, of course, never came to pass. Yeah.
3 or 4 minutes?
Yes, yes, sure. So, but for me, it's not, this is even not the most interesting stuff. For me, it is the fact that the more radical elements of the reform were not implemented. Why would you do, promote the creation of integrated human resources system, or link pay to rank, or to managerial duties, or describe tasks, you know, and build a more rational and comprehensive system? This had no fiscal implications whatsoever. So in my view, the only logical explanation is that introducing such a system, you know, a technocratic, if you like, system, independent of the political supervisor to sign, would strike at the core of this clientelistic bargain. The political supervisor would no longer be able to hand out benefits and allowances and wages in order to set political calculations. They would drop them of this capability, which was long established, and therefore would unravel this bargain because, as Panu points out, there was this deal made, implicit deal, that we give you allowances, wages, job security, and whatever, and you don't interfere with how policymaking, public service. I mean, if you look at the way policymaking is done in Greek ministries, it's the very concentrated powers at the very, very top. The ministry are the advisors, the secretary generals, who are political appointments as well, and so on. So if the politicians couldn't control the flow of money anymore, then of course the whole deal is off. And for me, this is this clientelistic approach is what network is what explains best the failure to implement these more radical elements of the reform, which had no fiscal implication whatsoever. Very, very briefly, the main takeaway points is that in a system where you have this clientelistic intermediation system, this operates endogenously as it's you know, it's imbued the logic of operation of both the political parties and trade unions and other actors. So it's very reform resistant and very resilient, even under the conditions of extreme crisis, because it would mean that these actors, political parties, trade unions, would need to reinvent themselves, operate in a totally different way if you promoted these kinds of reforms. And this is very, very, very different. In my mind, this is an example of what Pearson has called a deep equilibrium. He never described what it is. He just said that, you know, there are some cases, in some cases, you have networks, institutional paths and networks are so deeply embedded, it's very almost impossible to change. And for me, having a clientelist intermediation system qualifies as such an example. And of course, it also shows the resilience of formal institutions because clientelist networks are informal by, you know, by default. You have made in your work the same on how important informal veto points are in the Greek cases, in other cases. And one last point about this hollowing out hypothesis, what I mean by it is that in recent years in institutional literature, we see a lot of attention being given to the fact that such significant change, radical change can happen not only during critical junctures, but also with decremental slow change, which can come, can be consequential. Here we have kind of the opposite situation. Where you have layering, you have introducing elements of a reform, like creating a reform, making it simple, covering a lot of people, and so on, and cutting out most of the excesses of the previous regime, but not really changing the way it actually operates, going to a new, creating a new institutional path, creating a new system. So in a sense, the layering, the new elements of the reforms, in a sense, either by design or not, operate kind of to mask the fact that there is no radical reform taking place. Again, the scope of the argument, lastly, again, this is one single case study, obviously, so it has a lot of limitations. But I think, as is the case with case studies, it can be fruitfully applied to other cases, affecting the, for example, cases, prime candidates would be cases affecting the political relations in Greece, like mobility, promotion, restriction organizations. In other countries with deep client listing networks and Napoleonic administrative issues, like countries in South Europe. And also in public sector reforms, particularly the Holland hypothesis before the crisis, the kinds of problems you have described in your work on Europeanization, the limits of Europeanization, not only for Greece but for other South European countries as well, where we observe an informal formal gap in reform implementation. So you have formally reforms being promoted, being formally implemented, but actually on the ground the result is not that which was envisaged. I will leave that for later for the discussion if the complementarity between the clientelistic explanation and the other two, the administrative tradition and conditionality consistency hypothesis. That's all for me. I hope this was not too long. Thank you for your attention.
Richard, you want to John over here, and
okay,
we can pursue the conversation. I find this fascinating. By definition, it's the core of governance of any political system. One of the authors you cite, Erado Angolo, I remember some years ago referring to a case in Italy, I think in Perugia, where the council, regional council, had introduced a system of staff evaluation in relation to performance-related pay. And at the end of the first year, all staff had received the highest grade, the highest score. And the query was, how come? And the response came back to say, well, the task of the public servant is to follow regulations. Regulations were followed, therefore the evaluation is the highest score. It is not the task of the public servant to innovate, to interpret, to circumvent, etc. The task is the mechanistic one of implementing the rules. If they didn't implement the rules, then they are being they're not acting legally. So therefore, it's a case in which of a cultural clash. Let me, before bringing others in for the discussion, perhaps try to make two points, or perhaps three. You contrast a paradox between the will and capacity of successive governments to implement fiscal austerity, but their inability to implement something which is, in fiscal terms, far lesser important, that is, this aspect of administrative reform. And it struck me that from the external creditors' point of view, the intensity with which they would focus on compliance with fiscal austerity is far higher than the focus on a single remuneration system. Or perhaps in other terms, an external actor, an external monitor, could understand the process of achieving fiscal austerity much more easily, whereas the almost literally Byzantine mechanisms, internal situation of Greek public administration would test the monitors far more. So I wonder whether it is so much of a paradox, simply an explanation of the different prioritization given to the matter by external creditors. So it's a question of different priorities, different preferences. I think my second point is, with your frame, I wonder what scope there would be to focus down on one particular explanation or one hypothesis. Intuitively, your explanation of clientelism seems to be a very persuasive argument, but it's generic, large, almost amorphous. And I looked at your list and thought, well, yes, it's almost all of those in different bits. And I wonder whether the research design enables you to come to a conclusion that it's A, rather than a set of four or five. Did I have another point? I think it's, if there is another point, it simply relates to the Italian example, that the importance of culture, and surely a mentality of new public administration to say that there should be performance-related pay or whatever the specific reform might be is quite a cultural shock in terms of a new way of thinking. And it's not the only area that one might highlight the importance of embedded cultural norms, I think, of notions of conflicts of interest in the past, and the understanding of what a conflict of interest might be, what it is, or the absence of statements to avoid conflicts of interest in the public sector, etc. So I suppose the Italian example is to emphasize the relevance of a cultural constraint. But then, as I say, I'm not sure this is a story which is amenable to saying that it's to be explained by the first hypothesis and not bits of the other four. Do you want to give some comment, please?
On the first point about the graders, I agree, I mentioned it as well, that I think the most important fact probably is the high priority that the creators themselves were placing on fiscal consolidation. Fiscal consolidation had been the priority of the whole of three MOUs from the beginning, although there were nominally other important objectives, like, for example, restoring the national competitiveness. Evaluation policies, fiscal consolidation always the top priority, and we see that also in terms of reforms. And Professor Spanouf has done a quite thorough job documenting the various reforms, and others, Paul Panza, Global Alliance, have done work on fiscal reforms. There's quite a consensus among these analysts that we see a pattern also in the reforms. So the fiscal reforms were the first most fully implemented, satisfied, comprehensively implemented. So this is not you know an accident. So it's not haphazard. Some reforms were implemented, and others not. Certainly, the priority placed by the creditors was a defining factor of that. And also, we see also at the time. A time element, so there was reform fatigue, not only for the governments, but also for the creditors after a while. So, and I think they saw that because they were very insistent in the second, particularly the second memorandum, where they gave a renewed focus, because in the first it was mostly about reducing the fiscal debt. In the second there was a big momentum for reforms. So they were quite of efforts to these kinds of reforms. But after a while, they saw that, you know, politically this is a kind of suicide for governments. And after a while, I think the third MOU, the kind of let, you know, put the, take the, took the foot off the brake and allowed governments, for example, in this case, to backtrack or even reverse previous reforms. They were focused mainly on meeting the fiscal targets and on implementing the fiscal reforms. So other reforms gradually were kind of left to the fate. So definitely agree with you that, yeah, the prioritization by the creators is crucial in this narrative, why some reforms were implemented while others were not. But I think we had kind of like a coincidence of incentives here. So the creators were not pushing anymore for these kinds of reforms, and the governments were not very willing to make them either. So this kind of worked out for everybody. And actually, if you look at the responses by the people who I interviewed for this reform, the spontaneous answer to why these more radical elements were not implemented was that the top answers were political will, lack of political will, and opposition from. It was all political, in my view, and of course it was facilitated actually by this kind of focus of the creditors on the fiscal issues. Is one hypothesis possible? Yeah, I'm wondering myself. You are right, of course. As I said, 3 and 4, for example, I would say 1 and 2 as well have big elements of truth. Perhaps even more so for other reforms, even for this reform. Yes, we know Greek administration tradition has a weak institutional capacity, low know-how, and so on. So, of course, this was also something to some degree a factor. And of course, yes, there was a problem. I mean, PASOK in the early years was losing MPs, like, you know. So, of course, they didn't want, on top of all the fiscal measures, to start introducing other reforms. Obviously, these factors had an effect. But particularly the third and fourth hypothesis, I think, the consistency, as you say, which is linked to the cultural thing, and you mentioned the administrative tradition, which has a cultural element, the administrative tradition of this country. And the consistency of the conditionality strategy, I think they can work complementary with this hypothesis. So the last slide that you didn't mention to save some time. I think, for example, that the public servants' reaction was not because they wanted to preserve legalism, formalism, crazy differences in wages, centralization of power, and other features of the Greek quasi-Napoleonic tradition. I think both of these factors actually point to a specific issue, which is uncertainty. So the people reacted not because they liked the previous system, the Napoleonic system, the way it's implemented in Greece. I think I work at a public university. I don't know anybody in Greece who works in the public sector. I know a lot of people who is happy with the way the public sector operates in Greece. They are all like mad about how things operate on an everyday basis. So I don't think anybody was defending the previous system, but they were. I think the previous system, the features of the previous system, were manipulated to serve the clientelist bargain. The political administrative relations. So they were really defending this bargain. And this, I think, syncs with the fourth explanation, the conditionality consistency, which brought a lot of uncertainty to the people, because everybody was, they were afraid they were going to lose their jobs. So in systems that have deep clientelistic systems, it is this exchange that makes things work. These systems are characterized by lack of social trust, culture thing, a lack of social trust and the discount heavily in the future. So when you say in such a system, I will do a reform, it's going to be fantastic, everything's going to be objective and I'm going to work, you know, perfect, nobody believes you because they're used in a very different reality. And therefore, it's very hard to implement reforms in such systems. So I think uncertainty is the key here. I mean, people defended the previous tradition and reacted to these policies not because they liked the previous situation or because but because they were uncertain about the future and that they were afraid that they didn't know what they will be replaced, the system will be replaced with, and what their position will be in the new system, and if they would be safe. And it also goes to some of your work earlier, which is other features of the Greek political economy, like the weak welfare state, make this fear even greater. Because if you lose your job in Greece, you are a public sector employee, and you lose your job, then it's a totally different life going to happen. So this, of course, increases the fear and the reactions to any reforms of this type.
Right, I think the uncertainty aspect is very important. Right, we have several people. Bernard, Vasilis, Kira, Stella.
One is a little question, which is why did the clientelism, if it was relationships between politicians and labor unions, why did it persist even after the demise of left-wing governments and the introduction of right-wing governments? But more importantly, I wanted to pick upon your idea of seeking explanatory mechanisms that are relevant elsewhere, and particularly in relation to Napoleonic systems. I have spent in the last week or so a lot of time on telephones with French television and journalists asking about the pension reform which Macron has been proposing in France. Now, some of this, which most people probably know quite a lot about, is they're supposed to be putting up the pension. So people ask me about this. But the other component of that is the fact that France has a pension system which seems to fit perfectly with your discussion of the payment system. It's not payments between ministries, but it's payments for different kinds of public servants at a very fragmented level. It's not just railway workers versus other public servants, it's railway workers on the French metropolitan system versus other railway workers. And this idea of trying to consolidate the huge number of different pension systems has plagued French attempts to reform over many, many years. And listening to you, I got some ideas about why this might be the case. I have my own ideas, but I found listening to you useful from that point of view, and hence my idea of, you know, can we generalize this a bit more than the discussion merely about payment systems between different ministries in Greece today?
Okay. I'm conscious of the time, and I respect the contributions, but I wonder if you're happy to take several.
Yes,
basically.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Dimitri. So my two comments, starting comments, are probably very brief. Well, the ones that Kevin raised, but I will ask them differently. So I think the claim that clientelism explains it is, of course, plausible and appealing. But in the presentation, at least, I didn't see evidence that substantiates that. And, you know, it's the question that Bernard asked about trade unions and, you know, after the left-wing governments, said the left. Also that thing that, okay, it seems to be basically in relation to the Minister of Finance, but of course the opposition to abolishing the personal difference was across the board. It wasn't just people from, you know, very small constituency there, although very coherent and so forth. And the other thing is about, of course, that, you know, your expert, the people you interviewed, said that the most important reforms were the kind of the long-term, the pragmatic reforms, if you want. But not only the creditors, but also the political elite, if you want, or whoever was driving, or the driving seat of the country, wanted to deal with the fiscal issue. The fiscal issue was really a burning issue. You know, it wasn't just an obsession by Schäuble. It was that they didn't actually have money to pay pensions. Yeah? So, of course, you take measures. So the other one, then, you called it, you know, it's consistent with uncertainty and, you know, all this kind of thing. I take issue, I think, was the first point of the, you know, I thought I coined the term reform technology, but I think it was the first point of the reform technology point. It is also, it has an element of uncertainty, you know. If you have a good way of doing things, then you can experiment with things. You collect the information when things fail, and then you go from parametric to paradigmatic, let's say. If you do not have that, then if you don't have a good technology, then you know, you announce big plans, but then of course you abort them because you have no idea what's going to happen. You have no idea how you're going to do them, and even if you enact them, you have no idea how the lower level would actually implement them. And that, in a way, it's also sufficient. You know, in a way, we have over-explanation of things, because that, in a way, it's sufficient to explain why the big reforms don't happen. And then you go with very, very repeated and parametric reforms, which are essentially either cost-saving or reproducing different kind of relations with small constituencies within the system. So linking a bit to what Kevin said about, like, all explanations are valid, but in a way, I think, you know, the clientelism, I don't see the evidence that makes the clientelism, you know, this long explanation there. Basically, what we have is that, you know, they cut wages, okay, not all wages, then at some point they forgot to cut the personal difference, and they didn't do the rest. I don't see what is the different groups that substantiate the point about clientelism.
Respond to these, and then we'll go back to the more questions.
Okay, well, the evidence of clientelism. Well, I find quite convincing the fact that the same groups before the crisis and before they formed were gaining the most, and the same people were, again, the main beneficiaries after the reform. And an exception was introduced exactly to serve the interests of. I don't think that anybody forgot to phase out the personal difference. I think this is just letting the political elites, you know, just forgot. I mean, this is the big sums. Again, the 637 median, again, the stress is median, it's not the highest, because many people there receive much higher wages. At the time, it was higher than the minimum wage in Greece, which was 580. This is a lot of money for Greece's circumstances, particularly during the crisis. So I don't think anybody forgot anything. I don't find this very convincing. And I say this works complementary with the other explanations to some sense. Kevin said, yeah, perhaps I overplayed, if you like, the primary of clientelism, but I think it explains, it works with the others, it explains things that the others cannot. Why in this reform, not in others? I mean, you say, for example, about what you said about the reform technology. Well, I agree, but again, why it was the lack of reform technology in this reform and not in others? The pension reform, it's like 10,000 times more complicated than this reform. It has happened. Actually, it's the same as in France. The funds were integrated, more merged together,
exactly, yeah.
And it has taken place. If you ask me, the most convincing explanation is that this happened because, again, of priorities, it was political choice, because it has big fiscal implications, the pension system, the gap that was existing before, and it was covered every year by the budget. So, yeah, I think I would agree with you, both you and Kevin, that the creditors' preferences were very important driver in all this. And this has to be complemented with it, because, I mean, if the creditors were very insistent on things, on particular reforms, this would happen, as we saw with the fiscal reforms, with the pension reform. And therefore, I think I agree it's a combination of things, but you need also the client list component in there to make sense, I think, things. You cannot make sense without it. Because then it becomes a bit a hazard. You know, it's not, you cannot explain the pattern.
You can pursue discussions afterwards. What about Bernard's point that his second point was this is a case study that can play to a wider comparison. It's not only the politics of Greece, it's the politics of France, and it's politics
of the
pension
system. I did ask about the trade unions, because I did also wonder whether they not disappear.
His second point was.
Even this first point was a trivial point and actually relates more to what Vasilis was saying.
Okay.
Well, I think, but this is exactly the feature of clientelism. It doesn't have to do with ideologies. It is the trade unions are not left or right. The trade unions are clients. and they serve both parties within government. We've seen evidence of that in Greece. Decades is happening. Different ideologically, different governments pursuing similar policies and avoiding similar reforms. I think the popular, particularly the two dominant parties, the populist element in both parties has been dominant in recent decades, and they kind of dictated, although there were periods of time for modernization projects like that, but it proved shallow as well. So, in my mind. So it's not about really ideology, it's about establishment, material benefits, distribution of these benefits. And there are deeper clientelistic ties, I think, which are much, provide a much better explanatory than ideology.
Right, but now I want to know about France.
Yes.
I don't know about France.
Well, I interpreted that point to be that you know, you've got a single case study, but the dynamics of explanation may actually fit with other cases
yes,
as well.
Yes, yes. And thank you for that point. This is the point I tried to make, that they're very, very chastely at the end, that, you know, in times of crisis and pressure, and particularly external conditionality, you could see, I think a very good log of cases could be found in Latin America.
Yeah.
Latin America is populism and clientelism are core features of Latin American political economies.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk and very interesting topic. I'm suitably scandalized that the people who set the public sector salaries and approve kind of or design the tax code kind of legislate for themselves far higher salaries than for all the other civil servants. So I think that's, you know, a matter of clientelism, but also perhaps vested interests and corruption in a way, in right, you know, the right, well placed to do that in a way, right? My question is kind of focusing a bit more broadly on the objective of kind of moving, changing the mentality in the public sector from the mechanistic execution of tasks towards innovation and initiative and responsibility and kind of goal orientation. We're in these discussions frequently very focused on kind of the pay and evaluation of existing employees, and we don't talk about hiring new people who can, I think, be much more instrumental in changing the mentality, because there's only so much you can do within kind of with incentives within the existing human kind of resources of a ministry. So my question is, how would kind of a public sector pay reform need to look like in order to reflect the need to attract people with a different mentality, because there you might need differentiation. You might need something like the UK has, a fast stream with attractive salaries for graduates of elite universities. So how could we think about such a scheme in Greece?
Yes, and then you'd wake up.
Well, that's a very interesting and very difficult question. I think yes, the idea, which was also in the MOUs and in the laws, again, rhetorically, was to for this to be part of the human integrated human resource management system. So if you did try to establish to create a system such as this, then you could have practices just like the ones you describe. I believe it's quite difficult. I think it does strike at the cultural issues and the uncertainty. I think it will become easier through time because of new people. New people have different, completely different life experiences than the older generations in Greece. And also because of new technologies like the digitalization of public services and the way the public sector operates more generally. So I think there is, and we're moving there. You know, in the institutional literature, it's critical juncture is a difficult thing to appraise. It takes to actually say if there was a critical juncture takes a lot of time. We're not at this point. We're not able actually to judge whether the crisis was a critical juncture of the public administration. We perhaps can say that in 10 years from now, because you need to wait for a long time. I mean, many of these things did not happen during the crisis, but perhaps they set in motion procedures or changes in attitudes and so on that could bear fruit later on. We see today, for example, some initiatives, for example, in the Ministry of Finance, there was an independent authority created for the Revenues Authority, and they started a few years back to describe tasks And then they set up a performance system, and they started, I think, last year getting bonuses based on targets they achieved or not. And now something similar is there's an effort to introduce something similar in the rest of the Ministry of Finance employees. And something similar also started being implemented in the educational system. There was a three-step evaluation system that's taking place, and I think it's about to start for the judge the syllabus and then the units, the school units, and now they're about to start evaluating the personnel, the teachers. That would be fun. So
with no link to the salaries.
Sorry?
No,
no, no. This is about simply improving the so. Perhaps, you know, all this experience may set in motion things that perhaps 5, 10, 20 years from now we're going to see a very different way of operation for the public sector. It's what's quite interesting, particularly for this reform, that actually it was announced yesterday or this day, is that in 2024 it's going to be a new remuneration system. I don't think they plan to make major reforms. Basically, they want to increase, I think, the wage levels. So for each level, we're going to take it up a bit, particularly for the lower ones. But we're going to wait and see. Perhaps next year, we're going to see some more innovations in that respect.
Thanks for making an announcement like that just before an election.
Thanks. I'm aware of time, so we have one point, and the rest we can discuss at another occasion. I like very much your opening line that we have to move beyond the idea of success and failure in our discussion of reforms. And I think you have an opportunity there to do it a bit more. So I guess, yes, it's more of an observation that which one exactly is your reform? So you talk about the remuneration system, but also the evaluation. I would say that these are two different reforms. So if there are two different reforms, is it a success, is it a failure, is it partial implementation? And then also your definitions, you know, you talked about reversals at some point, but you're talking about reversals of evaluation when you previously say that it has not been implemented.
Yes.
So in reality, you could spend a little bit of time clarifying these concepts to be sure that you can be as judgmental or as, I don't know, negative about the reform you want to be sure that you really have the evidence there. And the question, the quick question about the clientelism point. Was it really clientelism or was it, I mean, did they get something back at the end? Or was it just the government, the different government, the problem is that the data is until 2012, I think, so we cannot really, I don't know,
that
I didn't understand from the tables.
The reform, yeah.
So
nothing changed afterwards.
Okay, so even so, you have data also until the end of the third memorandum.
That's it.
The outcome is stable.
Okay.
This data
but
is not allowed to be used anywhere else. It's not.
So do we know that the outcome is stable, or do we have?
No, the system, the rules, and the criteria, and the wage levels have not changed since then.
All right.
But a lot happened, especially in the early years. But then, who knows? You know, later on, that you know, you would cut your subordinates, let's say, salary by 10%, and then you'd give them a promotion, step promotion, so that they go to the next step, and the actual take-home pay remains the same. So, 5, 7, 10 years, whatever it is, now it is 10.
It's 10 years.
Yes, scary. after that, who knows what has happened with internal with promotions and.
Actually, they were frozen most of the time. No promotions happened in public sector for most of the decade.
Not.
Actually, because of the system was not, because they waited for the evaluation system.
So, yes, anyway.
And also, by 2016, the link between grade and pay was abolished again. So it didn't matter if you needed it.
Did you finish?
I still think we needed the data to be sure. But in any case, I think that my question about the client was like, did they really get something back, or was it just the government bugging? In reforms because of the need to have some peace. In 2012, if you remember, the situation was such that they backed up with many reforms. It was not just this one. So is it really clientelism or was it just a lack of ability of the government to push all these reforms at the same time? Because we know the prioritization. I totally agree with the previous points.
No, I agree there was a lot of stress and pressure on the government at the time, but you know, all governments did the same afterwards. Even Syriza had no pressure on the public. They never actually, Syriza reversed parts of the original reform. So I don't find any other explanation. Why would you reverse parts of the original reform other than appease and, you know, take on board and give a favor, if you like, to public sector employees and sort of political aspects, segments of the public service. And also, it is even at that time, the price is that you get to sustain the system. This didn't work much because at the same time, in their favor, because at the same time you cut the wages and allowances dramatically. So it didn't work out for PASOK anyway, it collapsed. But you preserve the system. Clientless system. I mean, you're not introducing, as I say, there is paradigm shifting elements of the reform, which would really change the landscape. And so you have the same system, and perhaps you're hoping that when the crisis is over, you can start raising wages again, introducing allowances, whatever. If the system is intact after this big crisis, then you can work with it. But if you break down, start building something new, there's no.
Okay, I'm conscious of the time. We could continue the discussion if Dimitris is willing in the George pub afterwards, to which everyone is invited. But I found this a fascinating talk, and thanks very much, Dimitris. Before thanking him in the usual way, let me mention the next seminar in our Hellenic Observatory series. So this is on Tuesday, the 28th of February. Our speaker is Nikos Vetas, the General Director of EOBE, the Foundation for Economic and Industrial Research in Greece, and also Professor of Economics at the Athens University of Economics and Business. Vasilis will be chairing that. The title is Intergenerational Mobility in Education in Greece. Tuesday, the 28th of February, at 6 o'clock, in the same room, in fact. Thank you to the musicians.